Happy New Year, everybody. This is Adam Sharkoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, episode number 453, our last of the year 2017. I hope everybody is keeping warm and cozy today. In New York, it is below freezing. We're going through a real cold snap, so I'm just happy to be indoors right now doing this podcast for you special. Abel Ferrara, the icon, the legend, the bad boy of New York underground cinema. Finally, I'm able to post this episode that we did. He's in Rome. I'm in New York. We did this a couple months ago. But curiously, at the end of the conversation, he wished me a Happy New Year. Could it have been that we did this around Rosh Hashanah? I'm not sure. But anyway, it was great to talk to him, even though I felt like I didn't do a great job here. I didn't feel like I did enough to connect with him, I'll have to be honest with you. But in listening to it, it's not so bad. He does open up and talk about everything and answers my questions willingly. And he's actually quite friendly and helpful. And when I just did the Kickstarter, he was very supportive of it. And he sent a quote that I forwarded to everybody and got quite a good response from that. So thank you to Abel for doing the podcast. Thank you for supporting my Kickstarter. And I'm looking forward to playing that for you. One of the biggest documentary films of the year is this documentary called City of Ghosts, which is being distributed by Amazon. And the editor of that documentary, his name is Matthew Hamacek, who I've known for a bunch of years, is going to be on the show as well after my conversation with Abel. City of Ghosts is a real incredible film. And it's practically feels like it's in real time. That's how immediate this documentary is and how powerful it is. So we'll come to that in just a little bit. First up here is Abel Ferrara, who's made so many amazing films over the years. I mean, I've been seeing Abel Ferrara films for the longest time, and there's a group of actors he keeps coming back to work with, including Willem Dafoe and Christopher Walken, and somebody who I've been watching going out to see his movies for so many years, from The King of New York to Bad Lieutenant. These are the films that I was first introduced to and saw in the movie theaters, and then I went back and I saw his earlier films. Recently rewatched The Driller Killer and Ms. 45 and Fear City. I mean, these are amazing films if you go back and see the real low-budget underground. But when I first became aware of Abel Ferrara was during the phase of King of New York, Bad Lieutenant, Body Snatchers, The Funeral, what else? Go-Go Tales, I saw at the New York Film Festival, and that's how I got to know Sylvia Miles. I became friendly with Sylvia Miles after that, for better or for worse. And he's made a bunch of films since, most recently 444 Last Day on Earth, Welcome to New York, Pasolini, and then some documentaries recently he's been shooting in New York and in Italy, including Piazza Vittorio and Alive in France, just two recent documentaries. So Abel is still incredibly active and steeped in the filmmaking. So we can always expect to get a new film from Abel Ferrara. In the meantime, here's my conversation with Abel Ferrara. Great way to go out to end the year with a conversation with this master filmmaker and a true hero of New York filmmaking.
Yeah, there you are, bro. What's up? What's up, though?
Let's get beautiful for each other.
Yeah. I'm good, bro. Just give me one second. Give me one second. I just got to answer this email.
Thank you, by the way.
No, it's cool.
We can switch over to audio, by the way, if you prefer.
No, it's fine. It's cool. All right, here we go.
You all set?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm cool.
Very good. Thank you, by the way, for squeezing the sense.
Is this a radio thing? I mean, is this going to, are you going to edit this?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I'll edit it. The show is usually,
all right, cool. As they possibly can be.
Exactly. with never sounding smarter than me, though. Just kidding.
Yeah, all right, definitely. That's a good motto for the radio station, or for the pods.
Yeah. I do operate out of a studio, but I have to book that time. And it just seemed like much easier just to do this at home because, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm at home. So.
And home is Rome.
Home is Rome.
And is
Rome, Italy. Yeah, right now Rome is, that's where I live, man. You know, that's where I'm working, that's where I'm living, that's where I've been here for like, I've been living like here for 3 years, pretty much. You know, I've been off and on in Italy for the last 10, 12 years, you know, making films here, making films in the States. But, you know, since Pasolini, I've been pretty much here.
Oh, right, yeah. Which, by the way, I got to see at the New York Film Festival a couple of years ago. That was terrific.
You liked it?
Yeah, I actually did. I think you have one of the finest actors working today. You know, you can't go too wrong.
No, you're right. Willem is, he's locked in, you know, he's locked in. And he lives right here. He lives right out.
Get out of here. Is that true?
It's the street there.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So you got a whole little community there, do you?
A little expatriate. Is that the word?
Well, is he actually, not that I want to get sidetracked on his career, but is that's his primary spot now?
Well, he works a lot, so he's moving a lot. You know, he's married to an Italian director named Giada Colgrande. So, you know, he's here. It's one of his homes. He's still in New York. He's, you know, but he pretty much, you know, the gig we got is you go where the gig is, you know, sure. The job is, you know. So, as a working actor, he's, you know, he's all over the place.
What is shooting like in Italy, since we're on the subject? Because how far away, for instance, is, what is it, Cinecittà?
Yeah, well, we don't build studios. I mean, we shot there when we did Go-Go Tales.
Oh, okay.
You know, so that was kind of nice, you know. We had it, you know, because of the nature of the film, that was an old, you know, we recreated a Go-Go club and the whole film took place there. It made a lot of sense, you know. But, you know, if you could afford it, these guys are, you know, is a great, a great tradition, a great, you know, the cinema here is, rich tradition. The guys really have, you know, it's in their blood, I think, you know, how to make movies. You know?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, and also.
It's very cool for me. It's very cool for me shooting here. You know, I got the guys. You know, the thing is with the financing, you pretty much need, if you're financing out of Europe, you need to use European players, right? And I'm fortunate enough to have a group here that I've been working with for the last 12 years, you think? That matches the group I have when I'm in the United States, you know, the guys that I've worked with pretty much since the beginning, you know?
Right. And so, that's something I was going to eventually come upon about this stage, having to still hustle like a madman to finance your films. But the whole industry is so different there. Even as an American expat, you can get European financing because you're working there and you're creating a certain amount of economy, right?
A lot, you know. So wherever, you know, once you have the money, then everybody's, you know, welcoming you with open arms. You know, the thing is to find the money, you know.
And it's our loss over here because you're not working over here as much, if at all. So the Americans lose because Abel Ferrara is working in Italy.
Well, you know, it's kind of a new world situation now as filmmakers, you know. So New York is just another Skype. It's a Skype call away. It's a mouse click away.
Clearly, exactly. And what about distribution? On the distribution end, is it if you're getting the European financing? And by the way, if there's anything you don't want to talk about, you'll let me know.
You know, there's no separation really between Europe and the United States. I mean, the movies we make, they show them everywhere.
But, sure.
You know, American movies are you know, international events, right? And international movies are now American movies. And so, you know, the distribution, it's you know, we're looking at the whole world, you know. Again, it's a mouse click away, you know. You're on the YouTube, you're basically available to the whole fucking world. They got to see a big separation between the United States and Europe in the kind of films we make, you know.
Right. Hey, and also I'm thinking about Rome and a bunch of European cities. I know that these cities are changing too, but try to make New York shoot in New York City anymore is it's hard to the locations aren't quite as, I don't know, soul. There's soul. A lot of soul is disappearing every day out of this city. I'm not here to trash New York City.
Yeah, listen, New York is changing from the day they bought it from the Indians, man. You know, it's constantly changing. So when you're shooting it, you're shooting a different place. So New York is what it is right now. And you know, these places only become the locations because of the story and the vision of the film. So if you know, Trump New York is, or, you know, that type of huckster fun New York is what you need, you got it. If you need something else, it's somewhere else. If you need 1970 New York, you better go to Istanbul or build it or go to Ocean Hill, Brownsville. I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. You got to go.
Yeah, it depends on the film. If you specifically need 1989 New York, I mean, I don't know where you got to recreate it. Here, you get more a little bit of a break. We shot Pasolini. Going back 35, 40 years was not that difficult here.
Right.
You know, I look down the street. Where I live in Rome, I look down a block, and it's the same as it looked to Nero. You know, I mean, it looked the same to Julius Caesar, really. I mean, it's just like this kind of shit here. That's, you know, they don't let people just, rebuild the city every 5 years, you know.
Has your relationship with cities, because I think of you as an urban, I mean, so much of your work was shot in New York or in cities anyway.
We lived downtown New York for a long time, so
right.
Our films usually set right outside the front door, so that's what you got. You know?
Exactly. But you seem to have also a bit of, at least earlier on, a love-hate relationship with the city, kind of spoke in some of the earlier films, I'm just remembering. Your characters were rebelling against urban life. You know what I mean? Like,
I was rebelling against everything.
I guess I'm thinking about the city itself, like the violence and the grit of the city. Is that something still that compels you at all?
You know, again, depends on the character and the story that we're up against, that we're choosing to focus on. You know what I mean? I'm living a different life. You know, I'm married. I have a 2-year-old daughter.
2 years old.
Yeah, can you imagine that?
Wow.
Got my age, right? Okay, so, you know, I'm living basically a lot different life than, you know, the nightlife of Lower East Side.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Manhattan.
I know you said you were married to an Italian, correct?
No, she's from Moldavia.
Where?
She's from Moldavia. But
oh, Moldavia. Oh, sorry.
Moldavia. You know where Moldavia is?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't. When I met her, I had to Google it up. I didn't even know what the fuck Moldavia. I never even heard of Moldavia.
Is it between
Romania and the Ukraine.
Okay. I actually thought for a moment it might have been an island, so I'm not quite.
No. Moldavia is like Romania, Ukraine. It was part of the CCP. You know, it was a... her mother basically was raised in communism. You know, it was like communist.
Was she?
How'd you guys meet?
We met on a set of Pasolini. She's an actress. She's a student / actress.
So your world really changed by making that last film.
We came to shoot the movie because, like I said, you know, we shot 4 or 5 movies in Italy over 12 years, but I never, you know, we kind of went back and whatever. But, yeah, you know, getting married and having a kid kind of settles you in one place, at least in the beginning, you know.
Yeah. In Rome, how's that for raising a small child?
It's great.
Yeah?
Yeah. Rome is very cool for us. And for me, you know, it's got the sense of culture. It's a beautiful city. The lighting is beautiful. The weather's a little better. It's still a city. I mean, you know, it's a city is caught in this immigration conflict that's of 2016. I live very close to the train station, Piazza Vittorio, uh-huh. Which is, in fact, I'm doing a documentary about it, which is like the first stop from Africa into Europe. So,
Italy?
Yeah. Italy in general. This is like the first country from where they land, you know.
Uh-huh. Are you talking about like more contemporarily?
I'm talking about now.
So like Africans migrating to...
Africans migrating to Europe, Eastern Europeans migrating, the whole concept of, you know, it's not like really migrating. I mean, these people are war, you know, these people are refugees. You know, these countries are racked by war, whether it's in the East, you know, from Afghanistan to Syria to, you know, these countries in Africa to Mexico, too. I mean, you know, this is the point. I mean,
did they take in a lot of Syrians, the Italian government?
Everybody, I mean, they don't know what to do. The people come, you know, Italians basically have a big heart. But, you know, it's the country isn't like really, you know, economically is kind of on its, is not in a position to just open up the doors to the third world, you know.
But it seems more.
You know what I mean? In Europe, too, you know, this is basically the deal, you know, and then the situation with the, you know, it's the Mideast and that, and, you know, but it's the same thing with the Mexican, you know, these are war refugees. You know, Mexico turns into you know, we have a war on drugs. Well, there's a war. And when there's a war going on, there's people that are left homeless, stateless, and are, you know, in transit. So you're going to deal with that as, you know, as what it is. Or, you know, you're going to, it's not like an immigration when my grandfather left Italy 100 years ago. They looking for work, got to the States, and it was nothing but work and opportunity.
But what was involved in, let's say, your moving to Italy, because you were working here and creating, again, revenue for the country or for the local, you know, economy again. Is that how come you were able to set up citizenship or residency there?
Yeah, I'm working on the work visa. So, you know, so I'm working. And yeah, we're bringing money. We're generating, you know, something, I hope.
Yeah, me too.
Made a little bit more, but we're doing, you know, we're holding up our end. Yeah.
Well, it seems like Italy, even though their economy might be really in a rough shape at the moment, like whose isn't, but they seem obviously welcoming on another level, because if there's a lot of different refugees or just different folks coming in from different countries that are in trouble, they're doing it legally, I suspect, and Italy seems like they're not...
Well, they're doing it legal and illegally and illegally, and it's a big, you know, point of argument and debate here, but, you know, the natural... You know, Italians are just open people. Yeah. You know, they're loving, giving people for the most part. So
that's been my experience.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So it's like if they had it, they'd give it. It's when they don't have it, and now it's, you know, the situation becomes rough, bro. You know, I mean, you want to start blowing shit up, you know. You're blowing people's houses up. You know, you're destroying communities. You know, Aleppo is not just some kind of... you know,
arbitrary
Mad Max desert fucking, you know, fortress. This is a city with millions of people, you know, and what happened, you know, I mean, because we don't see the photographs and these wars and all this fighting, even in Mexico, wherever, you know, there are no pictures, for, you know what I mean? There are, you know, there is no reporting on it visually. You know, when I grew up, Vietnam was on TV, man. You know, but after 1990, I think after the situation in Kuwait, they ended that, you know, so no one sees anything and everybody's bullshitting about it, but no one really, really gets it, you know.
Yeah, there obviously there's such cases where when there's been photographs or video, it makes a big impact. It really makes a big difference in terms of people's emotional reaction to others.
Yeah, right. And that's why you don't have any. And that's why there is none.
When you see the kids' faces, right?
Yeah, you see the reality of what's going on. But now you don't see the reality. You hear a lot of, you know, fucking gossip, you know, being reported as news. And then, you know. So we're doing a documentary on it. So we're kind of asking the guys that are here, the people that are here, at least we're getting it from, you know, the source.
What's the documentary? You're working on one?
We're doing two different.
One sounds like it's on Italy.
One is called Piazza Vittorio, which is about my neighborhood. So it's not just the immigration situation. It's, you know, the guys that live here. Matteo Garoni lives here. Carlos Santino lives here. There's actors. Willem lives here. I live here. You know, so it's like a Washington. It's like...
the one you did downtown in Little Italy.
Square, what Union Square was like.
Yeah.
But it's also volatile because, you know, it's well, you got to see it. I can't see it. Okay, it'll be done soon. And we're also, when I did a tour with my composer of the movies, Joey D'Elia, and the other composer, Paul Hip, players. We did like some rock and roll shows, basically, of the movies from the films, the music from the movies. And we filmed that, so we're shooting, we're cutting that now.
Oh, that's the one you already did.
Yeah, we shot it. We're still in it. You're
doing post and stuff. I see. But the other documentary is on refugees?
Yeah. It's on Piazza Vittorio, which is about refugees, too.
So you sent me some links to a couple of your documentaries, and then I was grateful for because I had missed them. And I love documentaries. I'm watching them every day, practically. Is it fair to say you're gravitating towards more nonfiction storytelling, or is that something you feel compelled to do at this point?
Well, you know, it's kind of a balance, you know what I mean? Because it's like, once we start, you know, documentaries are addictive. Like you say, you're watching them every day. Once you start shooting them and start doing them, yeah, it's a very rich format, you dig? And it's a little easier to do financially, and it brings a lot to the table of the narratives also, because what did I send you? Padre Pio, what did you see?
Oh, yeah, that one. You sent me that one. And the one about the festival down the block in Little Italy?
That was a while ago. But Padre Pio, yeah. You know, was also research because we're going to do a feature film on that. So we kind of do the documentary as research for the screenplay. You dig?
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, yeah, I've heard of that from a number of filmmakers that they kind of, one guy was doing a documentary project on this literary figure and also a fiction film at the same time. Of course, I think ended up both going kind of bust, but.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, life in the 2010s, man, you know.
But the documentary, I imagine it's a far more like visceral and powerful feeling while you're doing it. Also, when you're watching them, you're like, Jesus Christ, I'm having a strong reaction to watching this, even though at the end you don't feel as warm and tingly as you may if watching
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing a real deal, man. You're seeing real people, you're seeing real circumstances, and you're seeing, you know, the source of the drama, you know.
Have you always been that way? In terms of like you're working, even when you're making the fiction films, I don't know, it seems like they've always had a certain level of, I don't want to say documentary approach to them, but a number of them did.
Yeah, well, we try to keep it real, you know? Yeah. I mean, we just want to keep it real, trying to match the lives of the actors. And like you say, we shoot out, you know, we're street filmmakers, so, you know, we're just shooting our lives, basically. The actors sometimes playing theirs, you know.
Maybe you had more distance from that feeling when you were starting to make in the period in the 80s when you were making bigger budget films with some Hollywood actors. And
yeah, the actors we choose always are very, you know, never sang. I mean, I never thought Chris Walken was playing a role with Harvey or those guys.
True.
But yeah, I would say they were more.
Those guys would still work with you. I assume they still work with you.
I haven't seen Harvey. I haven't seen these guys in a long time. I've seen Harvey not long ago. I seen him in at a film festival. He gave him some award, but he's cool, you know.
That's a lot of what they do now is show up for awards. Mm. That time of the lives were.
Well, I'm not sure if there was the right material. They look like that. I'm walking Chris. I haven't seen, but, you know, Harvey, you know, he looks dynamic. He looks like he's ready if it's the right situation, the right, you know.
Yeah.
Right piece. I mean, he did that thing with Sorrentino. You know, I'm more with Willem, pretty much, just because, you know, we've done a bunch of movies together. You know, we live near each other. You know, we're doing this film together called Siberia.
Yes, I was reading a little bit about that, too. Where did you do 444? Was that shot?
That was in New York.
You shot it in New York, too, right?
That was Delancey Street. That was in New York.
That's the last thing you shot in New York, right?
No, I shot Welcome to New York with the Padres.
So when you were growing up in the Bronx, when was it that you discovered cinema? Were you, not through your parents, were they movie fans? Did they watch a lot of films?
I was a big movie fan. My father never went to the movies, but my mother, you know, she was like, you know, I mean, it was like a classic 50s big, you know, giant movie theaters. And, you know, the matinees were like focused towards women, and you know, she dragged us as kids, and it was you know, you see movies like what was that fucking movie? Lana Turner, and who's the director of Casablanca? Curtiz shot that film. You know, it was like a black maid and a white woman. You know, remember this movie?
Yeah, I do, but I don't think that was Curtiz.
Imitation of Life.
Yeah, that wasn't Curtiz. Was that Curtiz?
I'm guessing.
I know which one you mean. They were very, very stylized and brighter and bigger and bold.
Yeah, they were like, but they were films, you know, shot for housewives, what, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They were like melodramas or whatever they
right.
were, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there was some big-time filmmaking going on, you know.
Yeah.
I'm saying this is the kind of movies I was dragged to. I remember going, you know.
Because your mom, like.
My mother was Irish. She's beautiful, working class, came from the ghetto in the Bronx, grew up during the Depression, very poor, you know, very loving, giving woman, you know. So.
How many kids were there?
I have two sisters.
And
Italian, so it was like, you know, I have a very Neapolitan Italian family on one side, and then a very, you know, the opposite, like an Irish, you know, an Irish crew.
I grew up on Queens Boulevard, so I know the Irish.
Oh, really, really? And, yeah.
But my parents were kind of a little younger cosmopolitan types. They both moved in from Jersey, and, you know, and they discovered PBS and fell in love with all the great directors. But, you know, not because they were brought up that way, but they discovered it as well. So when I was growing up in the 70s, my parents were into Fellini, and they were big Italophiles. My parents went to Italy every year. Cause I think it started, their love affair with Italy probably started from the Italian movies.
Wow. And they brought you? Did you go with them?
Yeah, a few times.
Yeah, so, okay.
To Rome and to...
Well, you know the city, right?
A little bit. It's been a few years, I got to tell you. But I loved my trips. And when you mentioned how loving the Italians are, just basic, on a basic level, how welcoming. And that was totally my experience. And that was why my parents loved the Italians, because they were the warmest people. So, you know, our experience. We went to, what's the island again? That's sad. I'm forgetting.
Yeah, Sardinia.
Sardinia, yeah.
Sicily.
Sardinia. That was life-changing.
Fantastic, yeah.
It's an incredible place.
No, it's beautiful about Italy. Every time you go somewhere, it's like you're going to another, just a whole other place, you know. I mean, it's a very different culture. Sicily to Napoli to...
Yeah,
the north, you know, it's really a wonderful country.
I am hoping.
I'm Italian, so I mean,
sure, but I'm not Italian, but I hope that it hasn't changed. My dad really misses those trips. He the last time he.
This place isn't into that kind of changing. I mean, certain parts of it have changed, but you know, you could find what you're looking for somewhere.
And the food is still as fantastic as it is.
Off the hook, you know. It's off the hook. It's natural. That's the key. The food is half the key, man. You know, it's natural. It's simple. I don't know how you can eat in the United States. I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't know either. And I'm raising a kid myself.
I mean, you know, you're the chemicalized and everything you put in your mouth. So I don't know.
Yeah, everything's just. It starts with olive oil, right? I mean.
Yeah. Well, it starts with natural food, you know, I mean, for the most part. And, I mean, you got to search it out, I guess. I probably did the same thing in New York. It's simpler here. It's just, there's a culture of a life culture, you know, how to eat, when to eat, you know, what to drink, what to, you know what I mean? It's a different kind of, it's not, you know, I find it very, you know, very positive for my life force. You know?
And then it's healthy, too, so that's...
Well, that's the reason.
As much as I may prepare, for me, it's a challenge when I'm not in the same room, but this is great. But I just, you know, I can establish the connection a little bit better, but this has been fantastic, and you look great.
Thank you. No, you know, we just talk to each other. It's the best thing, and that's the only way to do these things.
I agree with you.
When people start firing these questions at me, it's like, you know, you get to, like, appreciate John Ford, like his, you know, his answer was, how do you expect me to know that? You know, why are you expecting me to know the answer to that question?
Wait, what happened?
I'm talking about, you see a John Ford interview.
Yeah.
And they'll ask him a question that, you know, was prepared, that was like thought about, you know, and you know, Ford's answer would always be, how do you expect me to know that? Like, you know, they'll ask about courage or, you know, some kind of crazy question.
Sure.
You know, when somebody feels like they have to ask you a question or, you know, this is a question that's going to, I don't know, you know.
Since you brought up John Ford, were those your films that you started with? Those types of Westerns and...
Yeah, I know, I'm remembering specifically. I'm trying to think of which ones were probably, you know, Ford Apache,
yeah.
You know.
Not
that was probably waiting for. You know, the ones with the wagon trains racing across the fucking desert, you know, the Rio Bravo, I'm sure. Although it's hard for me, because I appreciated that film later on. But, you know, I mean, these guys, you know, like you say, they were on TV, you know. They showed a lot of movies when I was growing up in the 50s on TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that show called Million Dollar Movie.
Sure, I remember that very well.
Same movie three times on a Saturday. You know, I mean, I was young, but I mean, you know.
I know, but that's when you absorb it like a sponge, and you can recite the dialogue.
These films three times in a row.
Sure. And then you're reciting the dialogue, and you're...
Then you cut to 20 years later, and you're in a theater on Times Square, and the same thing's happening. Because the audience is, you know, that's their fucking hangout, is the theater on 42nd and Broadway, you know.
Not anymore.
Five times a day.
Not anymore.
No more now. You know, so we're making films, you know, we're actually making films for that audience, and that audience is us anyways.
We just need a meeting place again, Abel. We need a
school. You're living where? Where are you now? You're in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Where? What part of Brooklyn?
Well, right now I'm in Park Slope.
All right. So where do you go to the movies?
Well, I still love going to the movies. And actually, they're building more theaters than ever in New York, to be honest with you. It's actually a bit of a renaissance. And
when I was living in Williamsburg when we shot Welcome to New York, what's that theater that they have there?
Oh, they got the Nighthawk?
Yeah, that was a cool theater.
Yeah, you can drink there, you know. There's now Williamsburg Theater, and I may be actually later today taking my kid to see, he wants to, of course, see the Star Wars movie. He's got good taste, and his mom is an actress, so he's going to have good taste, I think, or, you know.
How old is he?
He's 12.
Oh, wow. All right.
So he hasn't seen one of your films yet.
Don't let him.
No.
When he's old enough to vote.
I have to figure out which one it would...
He's old enough to vote again.
Yeah. I saw Bad Lieutenant in my 30s, and I'm scarred. So, no.
Yeah, right. You still weren't old enough, right?
No, that was... One thing I didn't want to do, which I could have done, of course, because I haven't said it, but when I was coming up in New York and discovering movies on my own, I told you... I had my parents were really into it, and my dad would drag me to screenings all the time because he got invited to like press screenings, or he was in publishing, or he got invited to premieres and stuff. But when I started going on my own, that's when I discovered you, because, you know, all of a sudden it was this rich time of movies in New York. I mean, there were so many incredible filmmakers like yourself. So that's when I discovered King of New York, Bad Lieutenant, all those films of yours, and man, that is just a great time. So you're one of those guys.
The 90s, it was cool. You know, a lot of independent financing, independent producers, you know, before these guys all sold out to Hollywood.
Exactly. There was that brief window, right?
There, you know, it was like a, you know, kind of a perfect storm of directors and, you know, support, you think?
Yeah, there was that brief window of time, right?
Yep, very brief.
All right, well, if possible, maybe I'll be a little bit more focused, but maybe if possible, if you have some...
That's fine, man. It's perfect. We'll figure it out. You know, I'm around, so right. I'm here. All right?
And
we'll pick it up, part two, okay? We'll work out a time. Happy New Year.
All right, Happy New Year to you, too. City Ghosts is currently available to watch on Amazon. It's about a bunch of young men who join the resistance, first against, I guess, Assad through the Arab Spring, and then the Islamic State, also known as ISIS, which replaced Assad, sealed the city off from the rest of the world and became the center for ISIS. And anybody who expressed any resistance to the Islamic State were jailed, tortured, usually executed in the public square, in fact. And getting any information out was not only very difficult, but of course treacherous. And so this group of young men, some of whom were able to get out, others who stayed intentionally in order to get images and to send them out to the group that got out, are the focus of this film. It's an amazing documentary. The filmmaker Matthew Heineman has done another great job after his last documentary, Cartel Land. This is just a phenomenal piece of filmmaking. So I really suggest you see it if you have the chance. Again, it's on Amazon. It'll probably have another brief theatrical due to Oscar consideration early in 2018. So here we go. This is my conversation with the editor of City of Ghosts, Matthew Hamacek.
في تهديد حاليا ضدي موجود على وسائل التواصل الاجتماعي على قناة تابعة لداعش بس دائما احنا نقول بالرقاوي الموت يموت.
The men and women of Raqqa is being slaughtered silently are real journalistic heroes. They work in secret and under constant threat reporting on the depredations of ISIS in their home city. Some have fled in fear for their own lives. Even in exile, they are in no way safe.
يلي هو جهاز انترنت فضائي اللي ممكن داعش انه تلقط الاشارات تبعه عن طريق اجهزه سيارات.
My wife did the movie The Family I Had, so, and the two directors were just on with you.
Your
right?
wife? My edited?
My wife edited that movie, yeah.
My God, it's an editing couple? It's just...
Yeah, I know.
Wait, exactly. So who's your wife?
My wife, her name is Tina Grappentine.
Okay.
And we met in the edit for Marshall Curry's second film, Racing Dreams.
Racing Dreams, sure. But that was the first one you worked on, right?
If a tree falls was after that. Yeah, so I was an assistant editor on Street Fight.
Oh, right, of
that
course.
That was one of my first gigs in New York.
What a great gig.
And Marshall was editing it out of his apartment in Park Slope.
Yeah.
And I would come, he would edit all day, sometimes with Mary Manhart, sometimes by himself. Mary Manhart's another incredible editor, and I would come in and work basically from when Marshall got up from the desk until when he woke up in the morning and started editing again, and I would sort of work the midnight shift, and he was editing on a computer that didn't have enough hard drive space or memory and would be constantly crashing, I'd get to, as I was doing my sort of boring AE jobs, I would get a chance to watch, 10 minutes of this thing at a time, and I was just like, this is going to be a great film.
I love Marshall Curry's documentaries.
He's the best.
And he is one of my first guests ever.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Before he was even podcasting, I was doing the show as internet radio with the major following I had, who would tune in on Wednesdays at 2 to listen to Filmwax Radio, and I had these half-hour segments, and what happened was, I guess I must have had either a cancellation or something, and I had nobody. And Marshall, just to show what a mensch this guy is, Matt Hamacek, I contacted him. I said, I knew him a little bit from If a Tree Falls, which I interviewed him for POV. I was a blogger for POV, and so I knew him. But I knew he was a really sweet human being, So I thought, okay, I can contact him at the last minute, and he goes, well, he emails me I'm literally flying in this morning from Africa or somewhere, right. Asia, I can't remember where, but I'll do it if I said I'll come and pick you up.
Oh, that's great.
And I'll bring you to the studio, and then I'll bring you home afterwards if you agree, because I have no guests, and I thought he'd be fantastic.
And
so
I'm sure
he agreed to do it, and then I went to his studio in Windsor Terrace, Park Slope, sometime later, did a longer format conversation with him. This is already at least 2 or 3 years ago. So
yeah.
It's been a while since he's been on, so I look forward.
I would imagine I've spent countless.
Oh my gosh.
Probably better part of my 20s in an office with him. And one thing I know about him is that he is just as good of a storyteller, I'm sure, in person like this, as he is a storyteller, for documentaries.
No.
No, he's horrible.
No, I don't know. He's just completely accessible and available. Just someone who wants to share and make whatever you're doing go well. And it's just a nice thing to have. I mean, most people are.
Right.
But, with him, there's this added level of warmth.
Yeah.
No, I don't know what the Currys did, but they did a good job raising that guy. And, he has the sweetest wife. And
he has a great wife, and his kids were actually the ring bearer and flower girl in my wedding.
Really?
So
that's incredible. Do you not have a sibling with children?
No.
I guess not.
No.
Because that would have been, you'd have to, yeah, that's good to know.
That would have created a big rift within the family.
Yes. So you've been with Marshall going back. That's great. And now,
Then after Marshall worked for Don Porter on Gideon's Army, and Julie Goldman also on that one. And then
I've been trying to get her on forever.
Julie?
Yeah. No. Well, both Don and Julie. I mean,
they're both great.
Julie I've known for 40 years.
Yeah. Really? 40 years?
More than that. 45 years.
Where did you guys...
45 years.
Wow.
My entire life. Well, we went to summer camp together.
Very cool.
Upstate in the Hudson Valley. And we were very young, obviously. And then about 5 years ago, I was coming out of the Tribeca Film Festival, out of the bow tie, the whatever it is today. It's Sinopolis, right?
Yeah.
And I walked out of there, and there's Julie Goldman looking essentially like the exact same person I knew 40 years earlier. And she saw me. We knew exactly who we were, you know, after all these years. And fell right back into a friendship. And so, yeah.
She's the best.
So she is the... And she produces everything, including your wife's documentary.
Every year she has, like, six films that are in contention for the Oscar. And the one year that I was working on Gideon's Army, she went to Sundance with... One of the films that she had was Gideon's Army that went to Sundance, but then she had three other films that were at Sundance at the same year. I mean, that's just incredible.
Yeah. It's a company motto picture. And like Sheila Nevins, her name goes on everything, right?
Right.
As executive producer.
No, but Julie actually produces these things. It's not like...
Ooh, you just threw down.
Yeah. No, Julie, I mean, when we were working on Gideon's Army, Julie was very hands-on.
Oh, no, I'm sure she still is.
She's great, though.
Yeah, and that's where we ran into each other just the other day at their holiday party
at the
Motto Pictures. And
right.
Yeah, I would love to get Julie on. Maybe, you know, I don't know. I think she's a little bit maybe shy of attention.
Exactly.
And
her husband, Chris, is a great editor. Mm-hmm. And sort of, I'm used to getting lots of notes from lots of different people. And I always think that he's one of their greatest assets at Motto, because he always brings these sort of editor perspectives to everything.
Sure.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. So your wife, whose name is again?
Tina Groppen.
Tina.
Yeah.
Okay. She edited The Family I Had, which Motto executive produced.
Right.
That's an amazing story. At first I wasn't sure because it's a little slickly made, you know?
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Not because of the editing, but I should say that, but just the productions and the...
Right. Right, right.
And I was grappling with the animation in the movie was such a sensitive, but at the end it was a very powerful film. And then they said they, in addition to the co-directors, they could get me Charity, the subject of the film.
And did Charity come in?
Yeah.
Oh, Charity's great.
Yeah, you should listen to it.
Okay.
I did. So that podcast. So getting back to why we originally started talking, the microphones.
Yeah.
Right? So there I am sitting with three people.
There we go.
Which is, you know, when I can get the subjects on the film, it always increases the number of the people sitting in the conversation. I did the same thing with Quest.
Oh, okay. I have not seen that yet, but I've heard it's incredible.
Really good.
Lindsay Utz was the editor.
Yes.
She's incredible.
The editors. Yeah. It's a beautifully edited film. It's a beautiful story. And with that, I also had on the director. But because the director, so this is as a podcaster, something I deal with as well, not just the equipment issues, but producing the segments, trying to be aware and sensitive to my audience. So this is a story of an African-American family living in South Philly, unless I'm mistaken. It's a mostly African-American residents. And the story is about this wonderful family. I said, if I'm bringing on the director, I really need to have somebody from the film as well, because
right.
I didn't want it just to be... I have a number of African-American stories with the white filmmakers.
Right.
And I felt like I can't keep doing that. And the climate, especially, is rightfully... dealing with this issue,
right.
You know, a lot. So, and fortunately, you know, he chose to work with an African American producer. She ended up doing the show with him.
Hmm.
And then at the last minute, we got the family, the subjects of the film on. So it was a terrific opportunity. I just find myself constantly embarrassed that I have one mic so we're sharing two mics with like five people.
But you're going to go B&H today? You're going to have your four input? tube.
My four input
gonna,
Zoom.
Everything's going to be solved.
I'll have four mics. So even if there's more people, they can. I don't feel embarrassed. At least if a couple people have to share.
Yeah.
But as an audio experience, you don't want to have too many people on anyway, because people are listening and trying to figure out
who's
talking.
You can't figure out who's even talking, right?
Because you can't keep track of all unless you identify people and say, like, tell me every time Matt you talk, just say this is Matt, which is what I do.
But they forget, and then it also just slows everything down too, right?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
But you know, usually there's some people that talk more than others anyway, and then people have a habit, of course, if there's a lot of people talking, they're going to talk over each other too. So in a way, fewer mics isn't a bad way of decreasing that.
Right.
But three or four, it's much better than just two, you know. So that is a very, very long-winded way. But I love how you just know all the editors, and it's a small community.
It's a small community, and we all get together. It feels like, you know, there's a couple different things. Like the Sundance Institute has these get-togethers for editors and a couple things like that.
Right.
We all get sort of get to talk about what we're working on, and I don't know, it's such a small knit community.
Yeah.
So it's a tricky job too.
Yeah. And then there's the Karen Schmier Foundation.
Yes, exactly.
Which my friend Garrett, I know, is if he's not the founder, isn't
he? Well, certainly him and Robin are both sort of
Robin Hessman.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, very involved and in the overseeing the day to day.
It's fantastic.
And, yeah. But I like bringing on editors a lot, and I like to find out, like, you know, the relationships. We mentioned Marshall,
and Dawn.
You worked with Dawn Porter, and then more recently you've had collaborations with Matthew Heineman.
I've had Matthew Heineman, and then also two directors, Brian McGinn and Rod Blackhurst, for the film that I did for Netflix called Amanda Knox.
Oh, sure. Amanda Knox, famous and, you know, very popular documentary from like a year ago.
Yeah,
I was looking through your filmography and I realized I've seen all your films.
That's pretty good.
And not intentionally.
Just by accident.
No, but it also speaks to your choices and your relationships and how you're...
Well, that's sort of the key to it all, right? I mean, I think it's an odd job in that you sort of deep dive into these subjects and into these projects which last, you know, sometimes up to a year, and you're basically in a very small room, normally much smaller than the room we're in right now, and the relationship that you have with the directors you work for is one of the most important parts of the sort of experience. It produces the best product, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to see eye to eye. In fact, a lot of times I found that the directors that I work for, that when we bring different sort of aesthetic choices and storytelling choices into a project, and we sort of bounce those off of each other, that's when the best product is sort of created. So,
has it ever come to blows?
Yeah, what has it ever come to blows? Not to blows. No, certainly not. But you have to get into the fights and the battles are what make the best product, really.
Because
you really have to fight for it, and you have to convince a person who you know, feels the opposite of you and say, no, this is what we need to be doing here, and they have to do the same to you, and that sort of push and pull is great and really, really important. So
yeah. I just had the editor on for I, Tonya, so narrative film.
Yeah, I love
editor.
That. I saw it, actually.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, I thought it was great.
And it really, I mean, you know, I was asking her, I said, how much is editing ice skating a challenge? Because it's a big part of the film.
Right.
Of course, there are these ice skating scenes, you know? So yeah, it was definitely played a part. I had to ask about that, right? But I like bringing on the editors. It'll be nice to put up the segment right at, like, shortly after doing one with the narrative, somebody who has a narrative background, somebody with a documentary. But the difference is that usually a narrative film also it could be, you know, a year in the process.
Right.
And whereas a documentary film, you know, you're coming in the editing phase, but that filmmaker may have been making the film for 4 years.
I mean, that's one of the... For me, one of the more interesting things about it is that for the director that you're working for, this, you know, especially a first-time filmmaker, this is everything to them. You know, this is their baby that they've been working on for so long, and then all of a sudden they call you up and they interview you and they decide, okay, I want you to do this, and then, you know, their film is in your hands, kind of, you know, for a period of time, and it's a really wonderful sort of experience, but it's always tricky. I mean, that's sort of one of the things that I always talk to people about, is that over time, and I've talked to Marshall about this. I've talked to another editor, David Teague, who I love David. He's the best.
One of the busiest editors, right?
We talk about the fact that you get better, I think, at scene work, and there are certain things, obviously, that you just get you get more talented at. But every film I've worked on, with sometimes in collaboration with some of the best editors out there, like Pax Wasserman, edited both of the Heinemann films with me.
Right.
Even when I'm in the room with Marshall, there's always this point you get to in a documentary where, you show it to an audience, the characters they can't tell one character apart from another one. The story arc isn't working. They can't figure out what the actual ending of the thing is yet, and people are confused.
Sure. Where am I chronologically, sometimes geographically, right?
Right.
All those things.
And this was actually one of the trickier things on City of Ghosts, which is the thing that I just did with Matt Heinemann, is that it's a story, for those of you who are listening who haven't seen it, it's on Amazon right now, and I think it'll be back in theaters sometime in early January. But
for Oscar consideration.
It's about a group of guys
expatriates.
Raqqas being slaughtered silently, that were in Raqqa, Syria, when ISIS sort of came in to fill the power void that was created by the Syrian revolution. And go ahead.
Yeah, no, I realized I just called them expatriates like an idiot, like the refugees.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah, no. And so basically ISIS starts to, the film is basically about how they are the first people that expose ISIS to the rest of the world, because ISIS's whole thing is that there's this caliphate, which is basically, they think they are trying to sell it as paradise to the rest of the world. And these guys in RBSS sort of secretly filmed ISIS, and then would either on the internet or to news media outlets sort of say, this is what it's really like. You're under ISIS control.
Yeah. This is one city, though, right?
But In Raqqa.
Which was, I understand, where the caliphate was. And that means
That was their...
leader
what?
Who... It's
yeah.
a religious, right?
It
for
was
those
Baghdadi, again, yeah.
Kind of self-appointed...
caliph.
So they sealed off the city.
Off the city. There's no way to get information out. Other than their propaganda, than ISIS's propaganda.
Sure.
So these guys basically started to find ways to secretly film what life was really like, whether it was that there were bread lines or that, that there wasn't this paradise with food everywhere, that
public
most horrific
executions
possible. I mean,
and
for anybody that disagreed or did anything. And so they would send this stuff out via the media or on the internet, to be picked up by media, and they started to expose ISIS for the first time. And ISIS obviously was not pleased with this, and started to hunt down not only the people that were in the group of RBSS, which stands for Raqqas Being Slaughtered Silently, but also the family members of the group.
Right. So a number of these guys that are the core of the film, the subjects of the film, who were able to get out. Some of them there stayed intentionally in order to get the footage, to get the pictures,
to get the
content out of Raqqa.
Right.
So some of them intentionally took the risk to stay in Raqqa.
That's right. And of course, all the people remain anonymous.
Right.
The movie basically follows. So basically, one of the guys in the group, he was trying to get out one day and got to an ISIS checkpoint. They discovered stuff on his laptop.
Oh yeah, like the logos
of the group, things like that. And they executed him in a public square. And once that happened, I think the rest of the guys in the group said, okay, the ones that were ready to flee or didn't have ties that forced them to stay back started to flee to Turkey. And there was a sort of a false sense of safety in being, 50, I don't know what it is, 50, 60 miles, or I can't remember what the exact geographic mount is, but they were far enough away from Raqqa where they had a false sense of safety, and then ISIS actually sent guys out from Raqqa into the town in Turkey where they were and found one of the guy, one of an advisor, mentor of theirs, who
leader of the anti-Assad movement,
exactly.
Who then it went on to be the symbolic leader of the resistance,
exactly.
Yeah,
and they murdered him in broad daylight in the middle of downtown in Gaziantep.
Istanbul, right? That's the border town, right? Yeah,
right.
In Turkey, yeah.
And then they fled there and went to Istanbul, and then fled from there to Europe, and they sort of went into sort of secret locations throughout Germany and other places in Europe. And so the movie, in a way, one of the sort of the trickier things for us was when Matt started filming them in Gaziantep, we had to basically recreate the beginning part of the movie, which is everything up through when they got to when they had started to flee. And I think that was, you know, we basically had hundreds and hundreds of hours of their footage, interviews with them.
Oh, right.
But, you know, Matt Heineman, the director, has a very specific style of filmmaking, which is, you know, he always sort of does this sort of fly on the wall, the cinema verite, run and gun style filmmaking. And what we wanted to do was
Cartel land.
And so basically, we had to recreate that feeling of being on the ground with these characters in a sort of a verite way for the beginning of the movie. And a lot of the beginning of the movie was context. It was, what was the Syrian revolution?
Sure.
Who are these guys? Who is ISIS? Things like that. But we had to still create it and make it feel like the rest of the film. So that was the first 18 minutes of the movie.
Right.
And I think one of the things that I've really enjoyed about getting feedback from people and audiences that they don't really realize that they're getting a lot of exposition and they're getting caught up on a lot of things.
It doesn't feel like that. It's true.
It's nice. You know?
I feel like I'm in the moment. Yeah, very much so.
And then once Matt started filming, obviously he applied his sort of that aesthetic style. Makeup to everything.
And it's riveting. And it's a riveting film. I got to rewatch it just, you know, again yesterday. And it's a thriller. But, I mean, so many people's lives were destroyed or are being destroyed. Like you say, even though these young men got out, you know, their livelihood, they love Syria, they love their hometown, Raqqa, their families are there. I mean, the fact that they got out alive is great, but, you know, like you say, the members of ISIS who were they couldn't reach them, they went after their family. So there's no rest.
And then one of the
so stressful.
One
you of the can see their stress.
Yeah, and one of the other interesting things that happens in the movie is that the sort of spokesman for the group goes to Berlin, and when he's there, he's doing a Syrian a protest or a march for awareness for Syrian refugees. And at the same time, the far right in Germany is having an anti-refugee march. They're sort of like neo-Nazis, basically, right?
Yeah, it reminded me exactly what happened in South Carolina earlier this fall. Or
exactly.
It was. Yeah, it was so disgusting.
And so these guys, no matter where they go, there's never a moment where they can relax and they can say, I think in a lot of, you know, one of the things that Matt always talks about when he's doing Q&As and things like that is that if the movie that you set out to tell is the movie you finish with, you've kind of done a bad job. So when we started working on the movie, we thought it was sort of a thriller about like guys trying that were on the run. And then in a lot of ways, I think it shifted multiple times. And I think a lot of what the movie is about people looking for a home and about what it's like to be a refugee.
Yeah.
And the fact that these guys will never find a home because their home now, their home at the time the film was being made was occupied by ISIS. When they get to Europe, they're met by neo-Nazis, and it's just something that they can
with
never
with hostility.
Escape.
And there is a general climate in the West where people are seeking refuge, mostly because that's where you can. There's a real anti-refugee climate right now. So they really go from the, you know, the... they go from one from bad to worse, you know,
yeah.
or worse,
yeah, no, 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 no.
worse to another worse, a flavor of worse, you know. So, yeah, what an amazing film and an important film. And I'm so glad that a film like that, again, City Ghosts, is getting such attention, you know, along with, even though you didn't edit it, but films like Icarus and Risk and all these other important films.
It's been a great year for documentary.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, I don't know.
Jane and all of those films.
Yeah,
it's just, there's so many great stories out there,
right.
basically. So.
And so many great storytellers.
Yeah.
And, you know, another thing that's sort of going on, though, is, again, City Ghost, by the way, is just a postscript one can watch right now on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe for free if you have Amazon Prime. I'm not sure.
That's right.
Which, by the way, I guess I could have done. You sent me the link. I guess I could have just watched it.
It's all right.
Because it's you know, speaking of the Amazons and the Neff, I mean, you know, Errol Morris right now has his documentary, which is kind of a hybrid, I guess.
Right.
On Netflix. And I speak to a lot of documentary filmmakers who are putting out content or stories in various different ways now. You know, some through web series and other internet as a platform. There are just more options is really what I'm getting at. For how to get the stories out there,
right?
I mean, traditional theatrical, let's say.
Well, even I mean, the sort of look. I came very late to. I started sort of in 2004, but I remember even back then it was sort of. You were going to get, for people that don't know this, most of the funding for documentaries comes from TV broadcasters,
right.
and then the theatrical release sort of happens after you get to a festival and. Somebody sees the film and says, "Hey, this either has awards potential, and we should put
whether it's a sales agent or a distributor."
Yeah, and for ours, it's Cinetic and both of them, and they've been obviously incredible. They worked on both Cartel and this one. And back then, it was basically like POV and ITVS, and then you would
Which
or
is
HBO
Independent Lens, or HBO Documentaries, and
I'm trying to think about what else was really around back then.
Well, there was CNN. That's more recent.
That was more recent.
I think Al Jazeera for a second and a half, and then there's also Showtime. Why am I blanking? There's one other, but
well, now there's
Molly.
A&E.
Well, A&E
exactly,
Docs.
and A&E is actually who funded both Cartel and City of Ghosts.
Okay.
So, but I'm trying to. I was sort of thinking about when I first got started, and it felt like it was just Sheila or. Public broadcasting, public funding. And now it's just changed to where, you know, there's Showtime, A&E, HBO, there's POV, ITVS, all the different places where you can get funding. And then now, of course, Netflix and Amazon has had such a profound impact on not only they're able to put in so much more money into a film, but they're also able to put in so much more marketing into,
oh my God,
into
that's
a film.
Correct. I mean, look at One of Us, you know, right, which is
Heidi and Rachel's
film, and where they said, you know, you'll have a million people looking at your film. Like, you know, I mean, even the numbers compared, I think, to broadcast are incomparable. I don't know.
I know when we did Amanda Knox.
Mm-hmm.
I've never felt just in terms of the amount of people that I would run into that would have seen the film and it became like the number one or number two trending topic on Twitter the weekend it was released. I mean, and just the, you know, they had billboards in Times Square. Yeah. I mean,
I underestimated. So when I was trying to reach Rachel and Heidi, because they did a Kickstarter right after One of Us premiered, and you know, they're just so, I was surprised because I just couldn't hear back. And now, in retrospect, I'm realizing just what must be like, the level of busyness and you know, demand that must be upon them those days and weeks after it premiered on Netflix.
Right. No, it's an incredible thing. Yeah. And, you know, in addition to, and Amazon has been equally wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, now also you go to Sundance, and if you have a film that people are trying to buy you now, you're talking about YouTube, Red also.
Oh, sure. Barbara Koppel had a film on that.
Right.
Recently.
And now Apple and Facebook, everybody's getting into the game.
Oh, is that true?
I mean, they're making
Apple
films.
Doing,
I don't know if they, I don't think they've come for documentaries quite yet, but.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
you're right. And then you have the merging going on also, which puts everything a little bit into question, like or into like a little bit of a into a curious position. I mean, is it right? Because when there's the acquisitions and mergers going on that are going on at the moment,
right?
So I with Disney buying.
Oh right. Of course.
What is it they're buying?
They bought Fox.
Excuse me. Of course. So that could change the landscape quite a bit too.
Yeah. I mean, documentary is changing it. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that a lot of people have been talking about lately is just sort of, you know, the awards arms race that's sort of happening and you know, the introduction of Netflix and people like this. And it's just, everything is fundamentally changing. Like, you know, the amount of money that people are spending at Sundance is incredible. And it's tricky for the traditional outlets or smaller independent outlets to be able to compete with somebody like Netflix who can sweep in and spend,
sure,
you know, $5 million on a documentary.
Yeah.
You know?
I know. I'm coming out of the fall. I had also like Griffin Dunn's film. You know about Joan Didion?
Oh, yes.
Which was a just want to make sure I'm correct. Yeah, I think that was a Netflix.
Yeah.
And One of Us.
Yeah, right.
Those two. So I had on, it was like, seemed like so many films were coming in that I, you know, and that affected it is also affecting, of course, the narrative world. At the New York Film Festival, all the major films were either Amazon or Netflix.
I know. I mean, you look at this year's, you look at the shortlist for documentary this year.
They're all in that.
It's Nat Geo has two.
Okay.
Amazon has three. Netflix has five.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so it's like, you know, remember, yeah. I mean, I still remember when I was first starting out and I was learning about all this stuff, it was like Sheila Nevins would have every film on the shortlist.
Yeah.
And that, and you know, and it's just, it's all shifting and changing.
Right.
And
Even Sheila Nevins is gone now.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Go. Oh, wow. So are you, do you have a new thing lined up now you are?
Well, I just got done editing and co-producing Matt Heineman's, he did a five-part series for Showtime about the opioid epidemic in America.
That's...
And so it's sort of like, and it's sort of told in the same sort of way that Traffic is told. So through addicts and dealers.
Yeah.
The law enforcement and, you know, somebody that's involved in Mexico.
Oh, okay. I just remember seeing about 5 years ago this film at Tribeca and on the – this is, he was ahead of his time, the, you know, because he reported – and he was interviewing all the people from this town in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to remember the name – recall the documentary's name, and it's on the tip of my tongue.
No.
But the point is that as you're watching all these people talk about how – they grew up in this town and how, you know, in such a short period of time, in a matter of years,
right,
the entire community fell apart because of the opioid.
I know. It's incredible.
And as you're watching these people who are visibly, you know, really upset and heartbroken, you're realizing they're all addicts.
Right.
That they are themselves addicts. So it's an incredible story, you know.
Yeah.
The only one who wasn't was the dentist. He was the only, and he was the busiest guy in the city, of course. So it seems like right now it's like all of those platforms we've been describing have had their opioid documentaries, but
maybe
not in the detail that maybe Matt's in your film.
Well, it's just more time. I mean, you know, I know that Netflix has something called Heroin this year.
Which
is supposed to be incredible. It's a short doc.
Yeah, I saw it.
And then. You know, we have 5 hours.
HBO did something too.
What now?
HBO had something too.
Right, that's right. And now, you know, we just had 5 hours to jump into the subject.
It's important.
And tell it from a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah, I mean, it's the leading killer right now, I think, you know, in the country.
It's horrific. I you know, you read about it in the New York Times and you read all these articles about it, but you don't really understand it until you've, you know, sort of, I mean, it's just sort of what's great about documentary is you get to see see the people and how it's affecting them. And it's all told in sort of the verite style. So, you know, you're on the ground with the police officers, you're on the ground with a guy who's making the product in the poppy fields in Mexico. And, you know, so it's a fascinating subject. And after I got done with that, I'm actually where we are right now, which is I'm
Radical Media,
and I'm working for Liz Garbus.
That's who I interviewed here last time I was here.
Oh, really?
Liz.
All right. So I'm doing her her series, also, excuse me, for Showtime about the New York Times covering the first year of the Trump administration.
Oh, great! That sounds like a great subject.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Great thing.
Yeah. I can't wait to see that one. And just anything. She's such a great, again, a great storyteller.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. She's the best. I'd never worked with her before, so that was one of the reasons I took the project.
I
was so excited to get a call and have her ask me to come on. Ask me to come on. So I've been with Liz now for a couple months, and we'll be...
Oh, good. Well, we'll get her back. We'll get you guys back. Get her on maybe together. You know, that'd be great. Because what was it? She did the one on...
She had Nina Simone.
What happened, Miss Simone?
Miss Simone, yeah.
Which is one of the best...
Was great.
One of the best documentaries, again, of the... Was it a year or 2 years
two
ago?
2 years ago.
2 years ago, right?
That was the same year as Cartel Land.
Yeah, yeah. Incredible. Great film.
Yeah.
You know. How is it working with a co-editor as opposed to being the sole editor? Is it present its own set of challenges, or is it something that you can define as being something you prefer or not prefer?
Neither, really, to be perfectly honest. I think that it's for me, it's been a great experience. I've co-edited with. Mm-hmm. Often with the directors that I'm working with. Marshall and Matt Heineman are both, if they would never take the demotion, but if they both ever wanted to be editors, they would probably be the top two editors in all of New York City. I mean, both phenomenal documentary editors. So even when I was working with Marshall, I was still co-editing with him. Uh-huh. And with Matt Heineman, I've worked with Matt and Pax Wasserman, like I spoke about earlier. And I mean, it's for the same reasons that it's good to be working with a director and you sort of bounce things off of each other.
Sure.
It's great to be working with another really, I think Matt and Pax are both some of the best storytellers I've ever met. And so to collaborate with them is just an incredible experience because
makes
me better. Yeah. I learn more. We all push each other to, you know, and we're all, you know, everybody wants to have the good scenes. So, you know, everybody's working just that much harder to impress the other people. So it's great. And I think, people often ask me this question, and I think the reason is because it's like, you know, is it too many cooks in the kitchen or anything like that? I think what's great about, especially with Matt Heineman and working with other people with him, is he is sort of the general that's leading everything. And, having somebody that is sort of giving us our marching orders and we have to, you know, we have to execute them very quickly, especially with City of Ghosts, because we started actually editing that at the end of August. And then I think we had the entire thing edited and put together and ready by the end of December. I mean, it was a very quick turnaround
Sundance.
Yeah, it was for Sundance. And it was I think Matt had shot probably two or three, I don't know, maybe 400 hours of footage. And then we had several hundred hours from RBSS. And then we had several hundred hours from ISIS. And so just the amount of time it takes to go through all of this. And then we had Dan Kohler, who is a co-editor of ours, and we had an amazing team of people that were sort of helping us out. So, you know, when you're moving that quickly and you have to get something done, you want as many talented people on board as possible. So you don't even think about like the...
Right. No egos, just talent. Yeah.
What? Yeah.
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 And this also on City of Ghosts, you also have the additional hat of producer this time.
Yep.
So what did that involve? Like in a nutshell?
It involved just sort of... Like, for example, when we would interview when the people would come into town and we would be doing interviews with them, I would just be involved in that kind of stuff. And and now Matt's away filming his narrative feature right now, so I'm sort of picking up some of the slack that he would normally be doing at this time of year in terms of doing things like this and whatnot. So it's great. It's great to just do something totally different than sitting in an edit, you know, room all day long,
sure,
looking at footage.
So, right.
It's nice, and it lets me see a different side of, you know, documentary filmmaking, because what I'm used to is I'm with these guys for, 6 months to a year, and they, like we talked about earlier, they've been on the film already for 2 or 3 years, and then they go and they spend a year doing press and doing all sorts of things for it, and then by the time they get done with that, I've already done another movie, so it's an interesting experience to see all the other things that go into it.
Yeah.
So.
And so the guys that are in the film, the subjects of the film, they're supporting the film, even though.
Yes.
It must be wow. And how'd they find the film?
How do they like it?
Yeah.
They loved it. They had no sort of editorial control over the film.
Sure.
They were able to watch it for the big note session that we had was
just
for
security purposes. Completely makes sense.
Yeah. And so Aziz likes to tell the story about Aziz is the main subject of the film. He's the spokesperson of the group, and he tells the story about how he came to New York and he got all these, you know, pen and paper and all these, you know, he's ready to write an essay about all the things that we had screwed up security wise. And I don't think they might have had one note, but it was a very small thing. And they loved the film, and that, you know, you always want your subjects to love the film.
Sure.
But with these guys in particular, given what they'd gone through and that they were willing to let us tell their story, it was just such an important thing for me, and I know for Matt, to have them enjoy what it came out. And now we've had trouble getting, because of the new immigration laws that Trump has been putting in, we've had trouble getting Aziz into America from time to time. But now he is, I think he's coming in a couple days, and he's going to be able to be with us at a couple different screenings of the film and be able to talk to it. And it's just so much better to hear it. Nobody wants to, it's like, if you can hear from Aziz, it's just so much better. And
so
just
much more
to hear
powerful.
How he's doing and how everybody else in the group is doing. And I just saw Hamoud, who is the character in the movie who has a son at the very end. I guess I've ruined the ending for everybody who hasn't.
Well,
seen
I don't
it.
Know if that's a quite a
not a spoiler.
Spoiler that his junk works.
Yeah,
essentially, that's all you're telling everybody.
And it's great. We both sort of became. My son now is just turned 2 years old.
Oh,
and his son is about a year and a half or so. So we both became new fathers at the same time. And that was sort of a great bonding experience for us.
I recently became a new father myself, except that I realized my kid is 13, so I've been ignoring him for many years.
There we go. You just looked around and realized he was there.
Yeah, it's not doesn't bode well for me, my reputation as a caring person. But well, I would love to meet these guys. Well, of course, I just wish them well. And
we should get Aziz in here at some
point. Yeah. I'm just glad their story is told, and it's so powerful and very moving. There's a scene. These guys are just you don't think at the level of stress the first thing in the morning when they open their eyes, until they go to sleep, and then it probably invades their dreams as well. But and there's a moment on a train platform in Europe where are they brothers that are reunited, and they hug and they just one of them just
breaks down,
loses it because it just catches up with you.
And right. I think also the same thing happens to Aziz at the end of the film.
Yeah.
There's sort of one of the most powerful moments in the film to me is when he has just found out that he has a death threat against him in Berlin, and he goes back to his apartment. And, I think he has put on a good face for the group and for himself and tried to sort of, get through life as anybody would, and I think there's just this moment where it finally hits him and he basically has a breakdown on camera. It's one of the most powerful pieces of raw footage I've ever seen, and it eventually catches up with them, and something that I'm sure they're still struggling with to this day.
Thank you for sharing all that.
No. Thanks
and
for having me.
It's great to talk to you finally after all these years, knowing you, at least since we met anyway.
Yeah.
Looking forward to new projects.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, everybody. Happy New Year to you. May you have a very blessed 2018. And, of course, we'll be back in next week with a new episode of the podcast. You can do me the kindness of going to iTunes and leaving us a star rating and a review. You could follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, and on YouTube. And soon we'll be on a few other spaces as well, thanks to our recent successful Kickstarter. Please do be in touch with me, with the show. It's very easy through those platforms I just mentioned. And engage with all things Filmwax. Thank you very much. It's been a great year. It's been an honor to put stuff in your head and for you to listen to it. Thank you for that. And we'll be back in a few days, okay, in the new year. In the meantime, have a safe and happy, healthy new year. Take care of yourself and the ones you love. Adam Sharkoff signing off.